Good afternoon, everybody. We're gonna go ahead and get started with the discussion portion of the event. We've got a few people trickling in, but I'll just go ahead and introduce the Federalist Society and introduce our panel. My name's Ashley Terrazas. I'm an attorney at Fox Rothschild LLP, and I am also on the board of directors of the Triangle Lawyers chapter of the Federalist Society. And if you don't know, the Federalist Society is a national nonpartisan organization of conservative and libertarian lawyers, jurists, law students, and professors that seeks to promote the rule of law, the separation of powers, and individual liberty. And we're also also co-sponsoring this event is the Regulatory Transparency Project, which is a venture of the Federalist Society that promotes a national conversation about the benefits and costs of federal, state, and local regulatory policies and explores areas for improvement. So with that being said, to that end, we're going to be discussing federal administrative agencies under the current presidential administration and looking forward what we might expect to see in the future. So I'll introduce our panel. First, we have Caleb Watney. Caleb leads the R Street Institute's work on emerging technologies, including autonomous vehicles, artificial intelligence, drones, and robotics. In this role, he regularly meets with policymakers, files regulatory comments, writes op-eds, and manages a monthly technology policy working group. Caleb was previously a graduate research fellow at George Mason University's Mercatus Center, working with the technology policy program. He has also worked as a policy research consultant for Uber. Caleb received his bachelor's degree in business administration from Sterling College and his master's in economics from George Mason University. Next, we have Joseph Rohe, who is also a Fox Rothschild LLP. He's a logistics and international trade attorney and a licensed U.S. customs broker and certified customs specialist. He regularly counsels clients on various matters pertaining to customs and trade, representing both domestic and foreign importers and exporters in multiple aspects of international trade transactions. He received his undergraduate degree from the Citadel in South Carolina and earned his legal degree with honors from the University of Durham School of Law in Durham, England. We also have with us today Catherine Ciano Mowler. She's a regulatory lawyer working with data and technology, most recently as senior counsel at Uber Technologies, where she served as Uber's regulatory lead in various U.S. regions. Prior to Uber, she spent two election cycles working with political data at I360 LLC as general counsel. Before this, Kat worked in weapons law at a boutique firm in D.C. She has also spent time at the Institute for Justice and at Fox Business News. Kat attended undergrad and business school at the University of Florida. She stayed at the University of Florida for business school before earning her JD from the George Mason University School of Law, now the Antonin Scalia School of Law. Please join me in welcoming our speakers.
Everyone, it's great to be with you. I think this should be an exciting event. It's a pretty broad topic, so there's lots of different aspects of this that I think we can dive into. As Ashley introduced me, I'm Caleb Watney. I work at the R Street Institute, where I cover a lot of our emerging tech stuff. And since that's my focus, I just wanted to kind of give a brief overview of some of the both positive and maybe some of the counterproductive aspects of innovation policy under the various executive agencies during this administration. So I'll start off with one of the positives, and perhaps the most positive in terms of like expected utility over the long run, which is the Department of Transportation's approach to autonomous vehicles. I think in very broad strokes, if you had asked me 5 to 7 years ago whether the primary barriers for autonomous vehicles in terms of full-scale deployment will be political or regulatory, or if they'll be technical, I would have bet a lot of money on the fact that the primary barriers would have been political and regulatory. And I think that basically hasn't been the case. I was expecting a lot more of kind of overreaction to, some of the perceived harms of autonomous vehicles, maybe a very high barrier of evidence before you can allow autonomous vehicles to be deployed on roads. But really, this Department of Transportation has done a great job of working with the various tech companies and car companies that are trying to pilot these programs. I think they've done a good job of simultaneously being flexible in their federal motor vehicle safety standards to allow for modifications of vehicle design in ways that might make more sense for autonomous vehicles, while also maintaining a strong, evidence-based requirement in terms of deploying on the roads. I guess I've been pretty impressed with the way that this administration has handled autonomous vehicles. I think over the long run, they have the potential to save a lot of lives. And so, you know, even speeding up the deployment timeline by a couple of years that you sort of cut out from regulatory uncertainty or regulatory delay could have a pretty big impact in the long run. I think a second positive thing that's happened under this administration is sort of with the White House and OSTP. In February, they released an AI executive order, which was kind of the beginnings of a national strategy, so to speak, on artificial intelligence. Because AI is so broad, it's a general purpose technology that applies in a bunch of different areas rather than a discrete technology. This ended up impacting a lot of different agencies, and there's kind of, I think it was a good first step, if not fully complete. It had a couple of components. One, it asked the various regulatory agencies to prioritize AI in terms of their funding mandates, in terms of their research and development programs. It asked them to try to start publicizing different federal data sets in an open source and machine readable manner so that you could increase the public's access to important federal data that could be used for machine learning. So it was kind of a good first start. I think maybe it needs more follow-up through Congress to actually make sure that the agencies are doing the things that we're asking them to do. But in terms of like broad tone setting, I think it was a good first step. And then kind of the final positive I'll note, although this is also a bit of a neutral, the Federal Aviation Administration has taken a better approach on drones in this current administration than in the previous one. But it's still not perfect and it's still not adequate, especially compared to what other countries are doing. One of the forces that I spend a lot of my time focusing on is global innovation arbitrage, which is basically the force by which innovators and entrepreneurs will move their technologies or their companies across borders to more favorable entrepreneurial or innovative environments. And you're seeing that a lot in the drone space. While again, it's gotten better, you're still seeing a lot of drone deployment happening in Canada, Australia, Switzerland especially, because they've given more certainty for entrepreneurs in that area. So that's, I guess, kind of a neutral. It's better than it was before, but it's still not exactly where we need to be. A few maybe areas in which there's been a counterproductive approach to innovation. One of the biggest ones, I think, is the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services has been cutting back a lot on sort of high-skill technical talent through the immigration system, which, so my area of expertise is especially in artificial intelligence, which right now we're seeing a major labor shortage. Demand is far outstripping supply in terms of the number of high-skill technical scientists that we need, and 70% of our students in PhD and master's programs in sort of STEM and machine learning are international students. So really the vast majority of our incoming supply are international students, and you're seeing a huge uptick in denials of H-1Bs. We're making it harder for spouses to be able to work while being in the country if their spouse is on a green card. And so it's really kind of, I think, been counterproductive given the huge importance of high-skilled talent for competing in these emerging technologies. And then the final area I'll spotlight is the Department of Commerce's approach on export controls, specifically related to emerging technology and AI. You're seeing, this is still sort of in the works, but last November they issued, or had a sort of a public comment period, suggesting far more restrictive export controls on emerging technologies. I think sort of some of the theory you hear about this is, you know, in a similar way that we were able to cut back on the Soviet Union's ability to get, you know, nuclear weapons during the Cold War through export controls, we can do a similar thing with AI in China. But I think that sort of betrays like a gross misunderstanding of how these technologies work. AI is an extremely general purpose technology. You can use it across many fields. A lot of the core developments are sort of theoretical in nature, and then you apply them to a bunch of specific domains. And so just trying to have more strict export controls on this, you know, very theoretical mathematical technology that's, you know, sort of at the heart of a lot of international collaboration doesn't seem to be a super effective approach. Of particular concern might be deemed exports, which is basically information traveling between citizens of different countries. And so again, this is still sort of, it's not finalized yet, but I haven't been super encouraged by the direction that the comments or the agency has been going. And so I guess I would urge caution there. I think AI is a lot more complicated. Our power in the space really derives from our center as a international research hub and a collaboration hub. And if we start to lose that, then we actually end up losing a lot of our power to compete in the AI space. So that's kind of a very brief overview of some of the areas that I think have been moving productively and counterproductively, but I'd love to dive in more in the question and answer.
Thanks, Caleb. Thank you all for being here again. My name is Joseph Rowe. I'm with Fox Rothschild. I'm a trade attorney and a U.S. customs broker. So, you know, my commentary here today is going to be a little more focused on that agency, on U.S. Customs and its partner agencies. And just to give you sort of a general overview, U.S. Customs is the largest law enforcement department or organization within the United States. I'm not sure their entire numbers, but they're broken into about three different divisions. So you've got your border protection, your border agents on the Canadian and Mexican borders, and also seaports, and then an air interdiction that works closely with the Coast Guard on drug interdiction and things like that. But probably the largest component of U.S. Customs is the actual customs officers and agents that deal with the entry and export of goods and services into the United States and out of the United States. To address the topic of innovation and impacts on consumers, you know, Customs has done an exceptional job over the last few years in automating a lot of the systems. So we've really finally now, after some delay, started to see some real movement away from a paper-based system and into an electronic commercial environment. So filings and the expense and time involved in making those filings for entry of goods and whatnot has really been streamlined. And they're doing a lot to constantly upgrade those systems in the IT infrastructure that Customs serves. At the same time, that of late has been a little bit derailed by all that's going on with the trade war, and that kind of brings us to the issue of effect on consumers and how consumers have been infected probably is driven in some part of your perspective or from your perspective, right? So some people are very favorable to the trade war, some are very much against it. I don't tend to take a political position one way or the other, other than to say that generally trade wars and trade disputes with other countries and impediments on free trade typically are not good for economies. We've certainly seen some of that in the United States. We've seen some wins, we've seen some losses as a result of our trade war, and primarily with China. That's sort of the big issue right now, although the issue with the European Union, Airbus subsidies and the WTO rulings that have recently come down, and some additional recent commentary from President Trump about tariffs being imposed on the European community, particularly France, is to be determined how that's going to play out. But in large part, we have seen a fairly negative impact on consumers. A lot of times, these additional costs are spread out quite widely, so you may not recognize it in your daily spending. But at this point, we're almost the entire tariff list. Basically, every product that comes to the United States right now from China, which is obviously a lot, is subject to an additional tariff of up to 25%. So a lot of businesses don't have that type of elasticity built into their supply chains, and they can't necessarily always pass that cost on to consumers. So where it has not impacted consumers, where there's not been a direct application of those increased costs, the companies are bearing it, and we're seeing it in reduced jobs. We've seen it in some job loss. We've seen it in reduced expansions, and manufacturing is starting to take the turn down as a result of that. I mean, it's a costly endeavor for both sides. The Chinese are struggling quite significantly as well. I think the primary concern for us is, China has more of a tolerance to wait this out, and this really is a war of attrition. So a lot's been in the news on what's going on with trade negotiations with China. Personally, it's nothing more than my opinion, but I think China's recent indications of coming to the table are merely in an effort to curtail additional tariffs or elevations on tariffs. President Trump announced that we were going to elevate the 25s to 30 percent, and then once China said, "Hey, we'll come talk," they backed off of that. So China really has no incentive to come to the table and negotiate before the presidential election cycle completes, because for all they know, they may be dealing with a completely different administration. I think that's probably a gutsy move, because there is a chance that the Trump administration is reelected and is emboldened by that reelection and comes to the table a little more forcefully with China, and maybe doesn't give such a, you know, won't be willing to negotiate certain points with them. So should be interesting to see what happens in the next few months, particularly during the election cycle, and how these tariffs and our relationship with other countries progresses, in particular the European Union, and which happens to be our largest trading partner if you look at the Union as a whole, as opposed to country by country. And then also recent issues with regards to Argentina and Brazil and the new implication of steel and aluminum tariffs on them, which they had previously been exempted from.
Hi, I'm Catherine Siano-Mahler, and I'm coming from more of the industry perspective. So my goal here is to give a sense of how a lot of these trends and metrics impact the way that businesses plan and think about what they're doing. And just out of curiosity, whenever I do a lawyer's chapter event, I'm curious, is the room, if you're a litigator, would you mind just giving me a quick hand? And if you're doing more regulatory or administrative work? Okay, so there's kind of a combination there. Okay, thank you. So what I'll address are a few topics. First, a lot of the Trump deregulatory efforts, which has been a deliberate effort overall since the administration first came into office. I'll discuss some of the mechanics and implications of the way that the regulatory process works at the administrative level. I'll talk through some trends, and then finally we'll do a little bit of a look ahead going into 2020, what we're anticipating in this next cycle and already certainly starting to see a lot of. And as we're talking through, I encourage you to think through the fact that when we're talking about the way that each subsequent administration addresses the tech world, there's more and more tech happening. So things that are technical, that are technology in nature, are increasing over time because there's just more of it. With 5G, we'll see an even a further path into that, into this area. So the way that different administrations or agencies are addressing the tech world will necessarily increase, or will necessarily be a shifting baseline as we move forward. There's also a trend away from sort of a left-right or more of a partisan approach here. It used to be that there was a lot of big business or a focus on what smaller businesses or smaller individuals are doing. And as we're moving forward in this world, that's less of a left-right divide. And so I want to just sort of highlight that as one major thing that we're seeing in terms of trends, at least from the DC perspective, although in the state level it might be a little bit different. And then finally, process is a huge area that I think this administration, more than others, has really focused on, trying to make sure that as there is either a regulatory or a deregulatory path, that happen according to the way the administrative procedures are supposed to go, with notice and comment, instead of more of a executive order or other more sort of happenstance way of proceeding. So as far as the deregulatory efforts are concerned, again, this has been a huge highlight that the administration has focused on since the beginning. A light touch regulatory environment can be a good thing for business, but having an uncertain environment can also be a little bit tricky when deciding how to plan, how to build, when engineers are actually constructing projects or building the tech, in terms of what they'll need to keep in mind when it comes to privacy protections or similar. Some of the examples of deregulatory efforts that we've seen that have been truly a deliberate effort on behalf of this administration have been, for example, the FDA increasing approvals of generic drugs. We've seen a move towards internet freedom. These are all, of course, terms that either side might adopt, but the goal being that there be less FCC control or review of ISP pricing. And then, of course, payday loans. It's been an effort to deregulate or free up the ability to get those loans. The metrics, again, coming through, there's some anecdotal data. It can be difficult sometimes to compare, depending on what the source is, but this administration appears to have truly decreased some of the regulatory cost by taking this more light-touch approach. And again, anecdotally, where one of the very first regulatory efforts was to require a 2-for-1 deregulatory to regulatory effort, there's closer to an 8-to-1 deregulatory to regulatory effort. So there truly has been an intentional and deliberate push to deregulate, to have there be a lighter touch from the agency perspective. From the mechanics and implications of this, this means that there is necessarily more analyzing alternatives. There's very frequently an economic look to see what the cost versus benefit is of one regulatory path versus another, or even having a deregulatory path versus another. There's still a process that goes along with that. There's always litigation that comes along with this. There's a lot of back and forth between the industry and the agencies that are in charge, but all of that has been an attempt to have a lighter touch when it comes to pushing on a lot of these various federal approaches to tech regulation. When it comes to who's actually driving a lot of this, at the administrative level, the president doesn't have as much control as I think there tends to be a desire to talk about in terms of what actual impact there is on what these regs are. There's, of course, executive orders, there are priorities, but there's always going to be a process by which an agency head and the regulatory team there, through which OIRA will be involved in a process reviewing the economic impact versus the benefits versus the costs of any regulatory priority. So I encourage you to think through this not in terms of being necessarily from a top down, but rather as a more organic process to work through what the right approach might be to these areas where, as an agency is studying some area or proposed regulatory approach, there is an educational process by which the industry works with them. The notice and comment period is deliberately geared toward trying to have there be an educational, a technical educational process that everybody goes through together. So there's always an evolution of what these priorities are moving forward. And in terms of trends moving forward, the fact that there has been this deregulatory effort from the federal level means that a lot of the tech regs have come to the state level. I see that a lot in state practice, that a lot of labor work, for example, has been pushed down to the state level because the federal agencies are less inclined to pick those up or more interested in having there be a lighter touch. There's a lot of antitrust action that's happening. I'm sure that you've seen some of the tech antitrust reviews, which are happening at the federal level, yes, but also at almost every state level. State DOJs are getting involved in those as well. Similarly, working through the privacy impact that we're seeing, because there hasn't been, there isn't currently a federal privacy bill in the U.S. That's analogous to some of the European or other countries' privacy pushes. We're seeing a lot of that happening on the state level, like in California. This means that there's a lot more of a decentralized approach to a lot of these tech regulatory priorities. But that also means that there's a lot more opportunity for industry to be involved in the process, for there to be more of a federalist style laboratories of democracy to approach in various ways, to compare how those work or don't work, and then to evolve accordingly. Going forward into the 2020 election, we're seeing sort of two big buckets of approaches from the various candidates. One of the sort of big bucket on the first instance is whether or not to approach breaking up big tech. This is a huge talking point on the left, particularly as we're seeing Elizabeth Warren sort of lead this path forward. In the smaller buckets, in the folks who are not so much talking about a breakup effort, there's a lot of talk about tax efforts, specifically looking at Amazon or speech efforts, looking at Facebook or Twitter, and thinking about how to regulate those, especially as the FEC has been much lighter touch, much less staffed than it had been in prior years. So looking through what we can anticipate coming forward, I would expect that what we'll see is going to be a lot of discussion about whether the antitrust approach to regulating a lot of these bigger tech companies evolves, where antitrust traditionally is looking at whether pricing is affected for consumers. There's a lot of effort to try to push this towards a more organic version where if there's a platform, for example, that competes with the entities or businesses that are selling on that platform or engaging on that platform, there's a desire to make sure that there's a bigger look at how the industry is impacted rather than just consumer pricing. The other big area is this Honest Ads Act, which is an attempt to sweep speech on the internet into the same broadcast restrictions that we've always seen on the FEC level. And this is a desire to regulate free speech again at the federal level. There will certainly be a lot of discussion in these areas. But what I encourage, as you're watching a lot of these trends and moving pieces, to think through, one, as we're modernizing these industries, and as the industry itself is becoming much more technology focused, technically focused, to see where the appropriate regulation should be taking place, whether at the federal level, at the state level, or if a more deregulatory effort is more appropriate to the various areas where we're seeing these proposals. And I encourage you to think through, again, what the process looks like, whereas the substance is important, the process is just as important, that there be an administrative approach to having a notice and comment period, industry involvement, and again, certainly transparency as to how regulations are proceeding. Thanks.
Yeah, I think those are all very interesting comments. I wanted to just touch on, I think, an interesting point that was brought up, which is sort of due to the lack of maybe federal involvement in some of these discussions, say privacy, for instance, it has led to more of a laboratory of democracy type approach. However, one of the interesting things that we're seeing is for certain technologies where the cost of differentiation across borders is much higher, maybe that decentralized approach actually just leads to whoever is the highest regulatory barrier becoming the de facto standard. So in privacy, for example, it's very costly for businesses to have a Michigan privacy stance versus a California privacy stance versus an Arizona privacy stance. And so realistically, what they do is just take whichever one is the highest, combined with maybe a market share analysis, which in this case would just lead to California, both has the largest market and the highest regulatory barriers. And they just take that and apply that standard all the way across the border, which is why a lot of the federal discussions around privacy regulation are focusing on federal preemption as sort of as one component of that, because I think due to the nature of privacy regulation in that regard, it's always going to lead to whoever has a combination of the largest market share and the highest borders, or the highest regulation sets the standard for everyone. A similar discussion you're sort of seeing happen internationally, GDPR is sort of affecting the way that U.S. companies are being governed, sort of regardless of what someone in Arizona would like their privacy stance to be. Their rules are practically being governed by the EU and by California, just due to the sort of international effects, which is kind of unfortunate. I think maybe the way to break down which technologies have those, aspects in terms of having this, it's sometimes called the California effect. I prefer a regulatory heckler's veto is my own term. But I think, yeah, basically any technology that has very high cost of differentiation across borders is going to have that. And I think that can also be a useful guide when we're trying to think through even on what layer or what level of government should a certain technology be governed. So something like electric scooters, if you are having different rules around where can you park, what's the speed limit, and what times of day can you operate these scooters, those are very easy to differentiate across borders. It's all just a software update. And so I think that's like a totally appropriate area to have be left to, state and localities. But if suddenly cities were trying to govern the manufacturing requirements in terms of how these scooters were being made, that would then again be very costly to differentiate across and perhaps be something that would be better handled on the federal level. So that's kind of a theory that I'm still working through, but I think helps provide some guidance on these issues.
Anything to follow up?
I don't think so. I think people have questions.
Yeah, they stuck me between two real lawyers up here.
I'm not even a lawyer.
I didn't pay attention in constitutional law class.
Okay, well, we'll open up the floor for questions, if anybody has questions for... I know that you guys talked about definitely a lot of different areas. I mean, this is a broad topic and there are a lot of agencies and regulations to discuss. So if anybody has any questions for any of the speakers.
I'll play in the privacy space. The Internet of Things, a lot of discussion that from the manufacturing and the application side, when you start putting some of this technology to play in homes, a lot of times consumers do not know, understand, or have the information to make their own privacy choices. And the companies tend to, and it makes sense from a company standpoint, to always do an opt-out as opposed to an opt-in on some of that. And so that information is A, complicated, B, not shared. And so when we start talking about the regulatory environment, what about the concept from a federal standpoint of letting it go to the states? I understand your argument about manufacturing, but go to the states and let them set up their consumer informational criteria. And then, I agree with you, it'll default to the, you know, I'll go to the highest order and hope that it takes me across every place. But I don't know how you solve this in an easy to discuss, if you only approach it from the company standpoint, or you only approach it from a governmental standpoint, because the party that's left out of the conversation is the consumer, when you think about the Internet of Things and how that's done. So I'm just curious if any of you have an opinion about that.
Yeah, I think it's a complicated area. One of the interesting things about privacy is it's something that sort of emerges and changes over time. You can see historically there's some interesting examples with the camera. So, you know, when the camera first came out, there was a lot of humming and hawing and freaking out about sort of the privacy implications, because prior to the camera, if you weren't willing to sit for a several-hour portrait or a sketch, no one could have access to the data of your face or what that looked like. And so there was a lot of freaking out about, you know, when the camera comes, like, how do we preemptively regulate this? How do we, you know, change our notions of privacy for it? And basically people adapted and evolved, and they said, actually, this is really cool. I want one. And that's not to say that there's never room for, you know, trying to be proactive in thinking through privacy, but just to say that maybe it is good to allow there be room for experimentation. So if you're thinking about sort of when to have federal preemption versus when to allow local experimentation, I think you could sort of have a multi-factor test in some sense. So one would be, what are the costs of differentiation across state borders? Two, maybe how mature versus how emerging is this technology? So if it's something that's still very much in the works, consumers are still figuring out what they want it to look like, that might be a time to let there be more experimentation as opposed to less. And then I guess, primarily how mature is the market, and then how much are the cost of differentiation. And so as things become more costly differentiation and more mature, that maybe be time for federal regulation. So at this point, I would say Internet of Things is still pretty emerging. And so even though you might have some of the differentiation costs that might still be worth it at this point to allow the differentiation, allow states to have different, you know, experimentation in what kinds of notice and consent do you want to opt in versus opt out. The other issue with, I think, Internet of Things and some of the privacy things is there are consumer externalities, both positive and negative. So it may be that the costs are really quite minimal for the consumer in terms of their privacy, but quite positive for the rest of society in terms of having more data that you can do machine learning on. Or it might be that, you know, one person's lack of cybersecurity in their Internet of Things device leads to security vulnerabilities for the whole block. So I think that's still a sort of a complicated area we're trying to work through.
And just to be a little bit argumentative, because it's lunchtime and I feel like it's almost situational ethics. Because, you know, if I think about it as a lawyer, I'm going, all right, do I think in terms of preemption clauses, or I think in terms of the old historic discussion about going interstate commerce? You know, somewhere along the line, I have to have a logical, from a legal standpoint, structure in which I'm applying these, as opposed to simply saying, well, gee, the cost of it should determine it. Well, that's sort of situational, and that's in the eye of the beholder at that moment in time. So I struggle with these conversations and trying to figure out from a legal structure, you know, if I'm a judge and I'm having to apply something, how would I get from A to B?
Yeah, that's why I'm an economist and not a lawyer. You know, so I have lawyer friends that help me then, you know, develop maybe the legal frameworks for this. But I think that's maybe why a good partnership of economists and lawyers is necessary, to consider both the costs and practically how you, you know, adjudicate.
Sure.
this is one that I come at from the legal perspective as well, and I think that the situational ethics is the right way to frame it. The way that the issue, I think, with a lot of this is that it's expectations of privacy that consumers have, and so it's difficult because it's one thing to consent saying, there's two sides to it, right? So there's the actual nature of consent. So in other words, sure, you can use my data for advertising, but not for that campaign or not for that business. There's not sort of a nuanced opt-out when it comes to a lot of this, and so sometimes I think what's difficult is that having a process by which regulatory entities and agencies are trying to keep up with tech, which will always and hopefully always be ahead of the government. If the government becomes ahead of tech, then I think that's probably a problem for the larger economy. The goal being to allow there to be an evolution of the way tech products are marketed and used and consent operates, versus having there be sort of a shadow regulation where you have an ex post facto, oh no, I didn't mean for you to do it that way, or if the consumer take on this shifts, then suddenly there's a different approach from a regulatory perspective. But the other side of this is that whatever the consent is should actually be what's done. It's difficult sometimes, and I think the reason why opt-out tends to be the preferred way to do this is that there's always a goal of being able to do as much as you can do and not more. So hopefully telling consumers what it is that you're doing with that data without going into too much detail or being too specific about that. And only if there's sort of a situational issue with the larger use would there be an opt-out or a decision not to have, for example, an Alexa in your home, which is a perfectly reasonable approach to the IoT. So I think that it's a good thing that there be an evolving privacy standard because there's an evolving use of data. But I think it's tricky because sometimes it's difficult to know the contours of what that actually looks like. To have your face, for example, be used, or to have your phone listening to you, for example, when you're not necessarily aware of that. I think you're right that that's the right question. I'm not sure what the right answer is, but I don't think, I think that trying to find a simple answer isn't going to be the right approach, because whatever it is, it will be outdated before long.
I'll jump into this. I don't represent billionaires, I merely represent millionaires, and so my perspective may be different. And as a lawyer, I always see things from that perspective. And from that perspective, I am no fan of the laboratory of the states. I'm a huge fan of federal preemption, particularly in the electronic communication world, because it's great in those situations where there is federal preemption, because then I can go to my client and say, okay, here's what you can do, here's what you have to do, here's what you can't do. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, back in the ranch where there isn't, and you're trying to figure out whether this is okay in North Dakota, and the sheer legal costs of trying to do a 50-state analysis. If you're representing billionaires, no problem. But if you're not, there's a huge expense to the theoretical beauty of the laboratory of the states.
I completely agree with that. I think that I think it always depends, right? That's the most annoying answer a lawyer can give, is it matters what the specifics of the federal versus the state laws are. And I think that the largest arguments for there being sort of a laboratories of democracy approach to some of these larger issues, and I agree with Caleb that the highest common denominator tends to be the controlling standard. That's necessarily true. The benefit, though, is that when you have smaller rules that are pushed down, there's more room for competition within small market. So if you don't want to have an international or a national product that's being used everywhere, you can start a business in Idaho and see how that goes based on whatever the rules are in that place. I think that when it comes to tech and privacy, that becomes more difficult because you'll very frequently be having products that cross state lines. But I think that the strongest argument for there being a lighter touch federal rule until such time as there's a better understanding of what needs to happen is that you would wind up having more likely a very heavy touch preemptive rule that would make kind of a moat around some of the bigger companies and make it more difficult for there to be startups or competition, and that has a different set of incentives attached to it. So I think, I don't know that it's clear which way is the better path. I think that this is the trend that we've been seeing. I think there's a lot of benefits to that.
And I think that, What it glaringly points to for me is the original purpose of the interstate commerce policy. I mean, why does the federal government do what it is supposed to do and try to make regular the trade between the states? So the states can be laboratories, but the federal government at the same time, and you mentioned this, could go in and try to make things streamlined so that there's not such enormous complication of trying to do business across state lines. So there's that. But I really had a question. It was supposed to be the end of the world a few years ago when net neutrality, when the FCC made some changes there, but I don't think it has happened. However, I don't know exactly what has happened. Has there been, how have things moved in that regard? I haven't perceived very much. Maybe anything behind the scenes that I don't know about.
So you still get your cat videos?
I still get my cat videos. Yeah.
I'm going to defer. I'm not an FCC expert. I'm going to defer to Caleb. He might have a better sense of this one.
So I'm not an FCC expert either. We have some other people at our street that focus more on that. My broad understanding is that net neutrality is like, it was kind of weird. It was like a pretty obscure regulatory issue that suddenly turned into this cultural firestone. And I'm not sure exactly like why that happened, but I don't think it was going to have a pretty big effect like either way. My understanding is that things have mostly kept on keeping on, and maybe, ISP investment has been slightly higher, but I don't know that we have enough data, to really know well what the final effect is. But it was kind of bizarre to me that it blew up into this huge thing.
I think the lesson there, just coming out of DC, is that a lot of times what you're seeing reported on something isn't necessarily what the actual impact is going to be.
Yeah. I have a question for everybody. You've all talked about different areas of regulation, and I'm just curious if there is any attempt by Congress to maybe get into some of these areas, or do you think there's any room? Do you think that that's a possibility, that they might be trying to pass some laws to address some of these issues?
I'll speak for the emerging technology portfolio of things. There's certainly a lot that Congress could do productively. Frequently, regulatory agencies can only go so far in terms of giving assurance in terms of what the market or the rules are going to look like. For some things like, international high-skilled talent, you really do need like an act of Congress to fundamentally change the system. Part of the issue, though, is that Congress has like a huge lack of understanding of how these technologies operate or what their effects are. I think, during the grilling of Mark Zuckerberg, someone said, so when I send an email from WhatsApp, there's just like a real misunderstanding about how these technologies operate or what they do. And so our street has been pretty supportive of resurrecting the Office of Technology Assessment, OTA, which would provide in-house, technical expertise to Congress with the hopes of leading to a better understanding of how these technologies operate. I think another debate that kind of happened in Congress a few years ago that suffered from this lack of technical sophistication was the encryption debate. There was sort of just this desire to have a magic back door that only the federal law enforcement could operate, but no hackers could ever get access to, and just sort of, tech guys, you do magic, make it happen. And so certainly I think there's a lot productively that Congress could do. I am not super optimistic that they will be doing productive things, partially because there's just this huge knowledge gap.
Yeah, I mean, with U.S. Customs, we enforce, or Customs enforces 26 titles of U.S. code. So there's a lot of legislative implication there. Unfortunately, I think right now Congress is sidetracked with this whole impeachment issue, which has posed some real problems for us, most notably with ratification of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. But we have seen some decent developments in other regulatory schemes through Congress. There are a couple elements of trade that are highly regulated. I mean, obviously food and drugs. One thing we've been dealing with a lot lately, hemp and cannabis, oddly enough. And so if you may know, there was a sort of a state pilots program that's been replaced now, and they're trying to come up with a federal scheme, but there's a little bit of delay in that. So USDA is sort of the agency running with that issue. They recently made some announcements about a federal scheme and some rules that would be applicable. But it's it'd be nice if Congress could get its head out of the sand and pick up some of these issues that are really, really pressing for us and for clients.
Mm-hmm. I agree with some of this, but I'll just add that I think for the foreseeable future, it's going to be a lot more focus on the election. And I don't know that there's going to be a real effort to be passing something, especially in an environment where it's not clear what the right path is forward. I anticipate that there will be a lot more posturing than actual legislative collaboration.
You have spoken a lot about a light touch of regulation. And, you know, just to capitalize on the fact that you're here from Uber, the Boeing 737 MAX approval process could have been called a light touch in regulation. It outsourced quite a bit to the industry itself. There are now some, obviously, really big questions about how much of a role that played in the disasters and loss of life that followed. What is Uber's internal view been of what has happened with Boeing and the real danger that company is in now as a result of the cascade of events on light touch regulation and that situation?
I think we typically aren't speaking for any industries we've been a part of, and I won't be speaking on behalf of any former company I've been involved with. So I'll kind of skip some of the heart of your question. There's certainly, I will say from my own personal perspective, there are certainly pros and cons to doing it either way. I think that a lot of the argument for having there be more industry review and less agency review is that there tends to be at times more knowledge, more sophisticated sense of what things are important, what actually has impact. Not also being involved in a lot of the work from the aviation industry, I can't speak specifically to that either. So I know that's not very satisfying.
But you are involved in industries that are on autonomous vehicles, right? That are trying to weigh in this new industry how to structure themselves. And, you know, it's of interest because this is so emerging, and yet we have this cautionary tale that's unfolding right now. Are there thoughts about that?
What I'll say again from a personal perspective is that I think that there's always going to be a waxing and a waning of where the sort of light touch versus heavy touch approach should fall, and I think it's very hard sometimes to do the counterfactual. So in the absence of, or if this had gone, if the regulatory review had gone a different way, how would things be? What would have emerged? I think it can be really difficult to do it. It's tempting to speculate on that, but I'm not sure that it necessarily is always going to generate a better answer, just because there are other incentives, other sort of regulatory items that come into play if there's a different approach from the beginning. So what I'll say is just that I think that there's no perfect path on any of this. And I think that what the goal from companies, from industries, from the government is to find what the right balance is. There's always interaction, there's always an evolution in that process. I agree with you that sometimes it can be difficult when it's not quite right, or when something goes wrong. It can be very tempting to say, if only it had gone a different way, this might have turned out differently. But I'm just not sure. I'm not sure if that's always going to generate a better or a truer truth. And I think it's more a matter of there will be very likely an evolution that comes along with these sorts of this waxing and waning relationship. There's always a hand in glove between the regulated and the regulators. So it's just a matter of who's doing which parts of that.
Well, someone who flies and who is on the roads and is concerned about autonomous vehicles, I'll just offer my own idea, which is that it's extremely important to incorporate the intelligence of the industry into the regulatory structure, but I also very much believe in structures that are accountable and not so flowing or organic. In other words, that there should be panels or other structures that we should be actively developing as far as regulatory processes that would inject industry knowledge, but have checks and balances that are structural and not informal, and that there should be a lot of discussion about what those kinds of structures should look like so that we don't handicap industry, but so that we do have meaningful oversight.
I think that's a goal of panels like this, to kind of discuss what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. Mark? I would be happy to quickly jump in on that. I think it's also important to realize that there is a very wide variety of what light touch or even heavy touch regulation can look like. It's not like everything is one model and, the failure of the, Boeing Max is the failure of all of that particular kind of regulatory style. It's also worth, I think, pushing back a little bit on the fact that the FAA is generally pretty heavy-handed in their regulation, especially compared to alternative models like the Department of Transportation and automobile safety. If you look at like regulatory approval times, to approve a new aircraft like liner through the FAA generally takes like 7 to 8 years, like hundreds of thousands of not millions of dollars in terms of like the of additional monetary costs on top of that. The FAA is kind of a weird combination of everything is pre-market approval, which is generally like pretty heavy regulation, combined with weird industry favoritism, where if you have a close relationship with the FAA, then you can have your specific like in-house regulator who kind of works for your company. And so I don't know that the failure of FAA regulatory approval in that stance is necessarily an indictment of any other model besides maybe that particular weird hybrid.
Yeah, I just want to jump in and add on that. I mean, the what brought us to the issue with Boeing and the 737 MAX really dates back to the late 60s. And so it spans a lot of different regulatory, periods as far as light touch or heavy touch. I mean, what allowed that to happen was we're on a 737 frame type certification from the late 60s. And because it was effectively the same aircraft, they didn't have to go through all those steps. But so it wasn't a result of any sort of light touch of current administrations or anything like that. It was really just a sort of progression or snowball effect of the way that industry has operated since the late 60s.
I think we have time for one more question.
I probably should Google my question, but since you have it, we've got to make sure we get our hour in. Yeah. Caleb, you indicated that the Office of Technology Assessment is no more. When and why? I left DC in 84, it was a big deal, what happened?
Basically, in the 90s, there was a heavy political push to cut Congress first as part of sort of broader spending cuts across the government. It was sort of this effort saying, hey, if we're going to ask for agency cuts and spending cuts in all these other areas, let's take the lead and cut Congress first. And so one of the first things that was cut was the funding for the Office of Technology Assessment. Now, I would note that statutorily it still exists, which is nice that you don't like necessarily need a new act of Congress to create it. We've suggested just refunding it. However, I do think it would also need some structural changes to be better reformed for this new age of technology. But it does have a leg up in the fact that it still exists.
That's good. All right, if there aren't any more questions, we'll go ahead and thank our speakers and wrap up. So,